Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. My opa, Henry Van Leeuwen, born on leap year in 1888, and a survivor of the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, told me that he survived the camp because of his spiritual strength. He weighed less than 90 pounds when he landed in Algeria after being traded as a prisoner of war. We had this conversation when I was 16 and worried about the draft and what was I going to do if my lottery number was low. My Uncle Leon introduced me to metaphysical health, the notion of mind-body-spirit healing. He told me that spiritual, mental, and physical health were intertwined, and spiritual health comes first, bolstering the others. My son Mike's spiritual health awed me as he grappled with his pending physical demise from metastatic cancer. Today we hear my sort of daughter, Anika, describe her travels to Latin America and her experience, as she says, with people who might see a shaman, go pick up some medication from their doctor, while heading to the church to say a prayer. Hi, Anika.
Hi, how are you, Danny?
I'm good. Nice to be here with you. It's unusual that I do an interview in person, so this is nice that we're doing this. Anika, how do you introduce yourself in a social situation?
Oh, gosh. I introduce myself often as a mother. If I'm local here, I talk about my two kids who are 12 and 9. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I talk about when people ask where I'm from. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about being raised by a group of hippies in rural West Virginia. I have a background in public health and social work, so I identify with those two aspects of who I am. And then I currently work as an organizational consultant. People always want to know what you do for a living, and so I often talk about that work as well.
Where were you when you first realized that health was fragile?
Oh, that's a good question. I could probably tie that back to growing up in West Virginia, mm-hmm. where many of us, you know, were quite low income. Although in many ways we also had really healthy lives, you know, running around out in the country and eating fresh vegetables from our gardens. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I did identify it so much until college and after, probably when I traveled throughout Latin America, saw quite extreme poverty and was really beginning to think about the health of these different communities that I was interacting with. And mm-hmm. that definitely led me toward a public health career, thinking about the health of populations, mm-hmm. thinking about the social determinants mm-hmm. of health. So that's an interesting question of when did I first realized that health is fragile. You know, my grandma Mary died when I was still a youth. She was not yet the ripe old age that you expect to lose a mm-hmm. grandparent.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, there was some of that as well.
I have this memory of you, and I think the memory is from a photo mm-hmm. that I have of you, and you're a young adult, and you're in Guatemala, and you're surrounded mm-hmm. by a bunch of kids. What did that experience mm-hmm. teach you mm-hmm. about health and wellness mm-hmm. of children?
Guatemala was one of my first experiences in Latin America. I say one of the first because my mom took me to Mexico during our homeschooling mm-hmm. years, but I was probably a fourth grader. Now that I think of it, one of the things that stood out to me was this grandmother who had like a child with her, must have been the grandchild, and they were sitting in this box on the street in a city, and the young one was begging for money, right? And mm-hmm. you didn't see that in West Virginia.
Right.
So that stood out to me. I continued to go back to Latin America for a number of years. And I know the picture you're talking about. I always loved kids. So I think I just, more than anything, what it taught me is that humans are really similar wherever you are. Okay. There's so much about the human condition that just is the same, regardless of what culture you're in. You know, we often think about all the differences, but kids just love to have fun and enjoy each other. They love when a young adult comes through town. They were interested in, I was in that picture, I'm the very pale pink minority. I'm tall, and so I stand out, and that's always an interesting opportunity for a white woman to be, you know, in the minority and experience what that feels like. I can't remember if it was Guatemala or later when, I think it was when I was in Nicaragua, and I ran like a kids camp.
Okay.
And, you know, they did sport. We just, the parents could send them down and we would organize sports for them and they would all have fun. And then after 2 hours, they'd go back home. And we were playing like pelota, like baseball style ball. And somebody was being excluded, one of the kids. And another kid said, "Todos tienen el derecho a jugar." You know, everybody has the right to play. The right to play, right? Yeah. So those kids, you know, their kids are wise and in touch already with, you know, how we organize ourselves socially and already sticking up for one another and the rights of maybe a kid who was slower or somehow wasn't fitting. Other kids wanted to exclude them. And this kid was like, no, everybody has the right to play. Yeah.
How did you end up having the opportunity to be in these different places?
Guatemala was a language school. Okay. And I guess, how did I get the crazy idea from rural West Virginia that I'm going to go to a language school in Guatemala? I spent some years after college traveling. That's a five-year span between undergraduate and going back for graduate school. So I did a lot of traveling and finding opportunities. And that was a language school, and you could live with a family to be more immersed in the culture and language. And then later, when I came back, I guess I still just wanted to see the world. And, you know, your son, Simon, had gone to do some work in Africa and through an organization that then I found out also did this work in Latin America. So I had the opportunity to go back to Nicaragua for about 6 months. And then even when I went to graduate school.
So that was through DAPP? Isn't that what Development Aid, People to People?
It was the Institute for International Cooperation and Development, IIC. We spent 6 months training with our group, training and fundraising in the United States, and then 6 months in the country that we were visiting. And then we came back for a couple of months to debrief. And actually, before I left for that, we were fundraising in Boston when September 11th happened. So it's one of my memories that suddenly I became much more aware of the relationship between the United States and our, you know, sort of global position. Then when I was in graduate school, I had the opportunity to go to Ecuador to work on a documentary film.
I'd forgotten that.
Back in Latin America. And that time I was wearing the hat of a public health consultant on this film team that had budding filmmakers who had just finished their degrees at the university and creating some of their early films, but really talented cinematographers. And so we went and interviewed people about their beliefs about health and how they saw their own condition. And what struck me is that in our country, we're very attached to Western medicine and we separate our physical health and our mental health. And then spiritual is like not even thought of as health. That's just like another domain. And in Ecuador, I found there was really the traditional indigenous views of health melding with Western medicine. And so your physical health and melding with Christianity as well. So you had your physical and your spiritual and your mental health felt much more interwoven. So you might go see a shaman and pick up some medications from your doctor on your way to the church to say a prayer.
It is so weird, I think, in our culture, how separate it is. It makes no sense.
And I think it's something we have to get past. Because in my own healthcare, that's been a real problem, that my physical health is seen as separate from my mental health. I've had more challenges in the depression and anxiety realm, but my physical health is good.
Yes.
And, you know, I think that's there's a missed opportunity to address the whole person.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
And there has to be something in there also about my spirit and how I'm finding purpose in my life. Mm.
So what else did you learn supporting that movie effort, the filming effort?
Yeah. That's a good question. So the film was called La Curación, The Healing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. That was, for me, it was really the degree to which the spirit was integrated into the physical health.
Mm-hmm.
From what I could tell as an outsider, and who also, the, you know, Spanish is definitely a second language for me. Mm-hmm. So there's always the possibility that things were lost in translation to me. But that's what stood out, was that it didn't even feel like there was language to separate out your body and your spirit. It felt like the two were...
language.
Right. Yeah. The two were just connected.
Yeah.
So you would... they weren't even two. They were one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should take a moment to share a little bit about how we know each other.
Yeah.
Since when I talk about you with people, I say my sort of daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've known you, I think, almost all your life, mm-hmm. maybe not the first few months, but other than that, I've known you all your life, and my kids, definitely, you're their sister.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandkids, you're their aunt, mm-hmm. and there's just no question. And your kids are their cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in a community in West Virginia together, and we homeschooled together. How do you describe
So it fits really well with how you describe, because I say that you and Anne are my extra set of parents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that in the sense of if something happened to my parents, then I would come to you, the next in line, mm-hmm. for the role that parents play in your life, all the roles. But also, I've told you that you and Anne have this long-lasting relationship, and my parents separated when I was young,
mm-hmm.
and I only know them as separated, and they're good friends. But you've also been the role model for me for a love that lasts throughout mm-hmm. your life, and the work that it takes to commit to and maintain. I talk about your sons as being my brothers from another mother. And certainly when you moved away, and I want to say we were in like middle school-ish, mm-hmm. you know, it felt like my half of my family was, you know, moving far mm-hmm. away.
Yeah.
And that as an only child, mm-hmm. technically,
yes.
yeah, your sons have been my brothers, and I think of you as my extra dad.
I one of the things I always appreciated most was that when Simon, who's my oldest son, got married, he had best people.
Yeah.
And not best men.
That's right.
And you were there.
Yeah. And then I got married and you officiated the wedding,
right.
I had only best men.
Yeah. Right. That's
Simon
right.
and Reuben.
Yeah. That's right. Oh. Anyway. Okay. When you came to Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. early on in you were working with students who were studying at the University of Michigan that were residing in the States on student visas,
mm-hmm.
right? And you had a role. Tell me about that, mm-hmm. that role and your experience with all these different cultures of people and dealing with regulation and all that.
Well, first of all, I was thinking about why did I come to Ann Arbor, and at the time I had been traveling so much around the world, and I felt suddenly like I wanted to put down roots.
Mm-hmm.
And your son was here, and his mm-hmm. wife, and other longtime friends of ours who we'd known, you know, since West Virginia, since mm-hmm. growing up, and so it felt like a place I could move to and put down roots and have that connection that maybe I hadn't had for a number of years because mm-hmm. I was traveling so much. And because I had done all that traveling, I was drawn to, you know, international work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did work at a center at the university where we applied for visas for folks who wanted to come over either as students mm-hmm. or to study or as researchers, mm-hmm. faculty members, which was interesting work because you got to meet people from all over the place, and really frustrating work because you're working with government regulations, which are changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, are really seem to be designed to make it really challenging for people to get here to work and study. So I found it to be the kind of work that sort of drains your soul. Ultimately, you know, it's not, it inspired me to go back to school mm-hmm. because I thought, well, I could keep doing this and kind of move up mm-hmm. in the current office I'm in, or mm-hmm. I could go back to school. And so it did push me in that direction.
When we first talked about having this conversation mm-hmm. for the podcast, in my frame was thinking about you as an advocate. Mm-hmm. I never heard you, you know, call yourself that. Mm-hmm. You think about what's going on with people and what they need mm-hmm. and you advocate for people, but mm-hmm. it's not a label that you put on yourself. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like yeah. your sense of, gosh, I don't even know how to say what's right, you mm-hmm. know, and going to bat for people.
Right. Justice. So Simon posted something on Facebook not so long ago. It was kind of acknowledging the strengths and tendencies among some of his old friends from West Virginia. Mm-hmm.
And Simon's my oldest son.
Yeah, your oldest yes. son. And what he pegged me with was an unusual amount of empathy.
Mm, okay.
Right? And so mm-hmm, it was yeah. I was holding a mirror up to me, and I was like, oh, yeah, that is something about me, mm-hmm, right? Yeah. And so I think that I have, throughout my life, had the ability and / tendency mm-hmm. to put myself in other people's shoes mm-hmm. and feel how they feel. Mm-hmm. In that sense, I think that I am a natural advocate mm-hmm. because I understand where someone's coming from, mm-hmm. or I can imagine and even viscerally sometimes feel what that person might be mm-hmm. feeling. And then you couple that with my father's side of my family having a really strong social justice orientation, mm-hmm. being really aware of the role of power in society and that there are the haves and the have-nots in all different domains. Mm-hmm. So certainly growing up in West Virginia, many of us were really low socioeconomic status. When I went off to college, mm-hmm. I was different mm-hmm. than many of the other folks at my college. I went to my work-study job mm-hmm. while they would, you know, maybe go spend money on dad's credit card, and I thought that was crazy. I'd never heard of dad's credit card, you know, being available for such things. For me, growing up mm-hmm. as a woman, there are many times that I have seen the ways in which, you know, we're treated differently than men mm-hmm. in those small, you know, kind of microaggression ways. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm a white woman. I really don't know what it's like to be a person of color in this country. Mm-hmm. And yet, I guess I can imagine and I can empathize mm-hmm. and I can see where a lifetime of being seen as different from the majority. Mm-hmm. And you could extend this also to physical abilities. Mm-hmm. I think I do have a sense that it's just not right that people can kind of wield power over others and then it comes from the people who they're stronger yeah. or they have more money mm-hmm. or, mm-hmm. and I can see it in my own children now. So my kids have even been known to, if only one of them is getting something, give it up because the other one's not getting it. Mm-hmm. So I sort of, you know, punished one kid for doing mm-hmm. something bad. And I said, well, now you don't get to have this thing, this mm-hmm. treat or whatever. And the other kid said, well, then I'm not going to have mine either.
Yeah.
So I can see our children are mirrors for us.
Yes.
So now I can see what I consider to be a social justice lens. You know, this is not fair. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even though it's really tiring as a parent mm-hmm. to get challenged on the fairness of everything, I hope that they take that into their lives and they look around them. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much about what's fair for them personally, because they have really privileged mm-hmm. lives, mm-hmm. but to look around and say, who's not getting a fair chance mm-hmm. at the life that I have the opportunity to lead?
Wow. With these experiences that you've had, how do you impact that? So it's one thing, like you said, that your kids are the mirror of you. Mm-hmm. I remember having conversations with you and Simon and Ruben that the importance of example, mm-hmm. that's a really big deal. On the other hand, that circle is small, mm-hmm. you know, that's like a personal level.
Right.
And so it seems like you think about the personal as well as the societal.
Right.
What have you experienced in terms of trying to impact something on a larger scale than your immediate circle?
When I was in college, I studied for my master's degrees. I did public health and social work.
Okay.
And part of it was sort of bridging that. Public health is very much the macro level, and social work can be interpersonal or macro. And I sort of was drawn to the macro because I thought, well, you can have an impact at scale when you're working on at the organizational level or at the policy level. And yet, I think I've always been drawn also to the interpersonal and sitting down with one person and finding out what drives them. And what I've come to believe is that we have a false sort of sense of individualism in this country and uniqueness, and that we are individuals who are very different and have a lot of, you know, control over our own destiny and so on. And that really there are so many patterns and ways in which we are influenced by the societal structures and in which we live, and that there are many, many similarities. Even the voices we have in our own heads that are telling us the little self-talk stuff, it turns out a lot of that is really common across people. And so there's something there that the individual really is very similar to the the larger community or culture. And so now in my work, I've settled into organizational consulting. So here I am meeting with organizations and finding out where they're struggling or doing strategic planning for where they'd like to go next. And again, seeing that sometimes it's a very personal individual challenge, and yet you see the same challenges across multiple organizations. You see group dynamics across organizations. And, you know, going back to your question about then how can you have influence?
Right.
I'm a generalist. I'm now a proud generalist. Used to be a questioning generalist.
Generalist meaning as opposed to a specialist.
As opposed to a specialist. Okay. So I went to a university where there were so many specialists and so many people who spent their careers really getting incredible depth on a certain topic.
Right.
And I felt like what do you want to be when you grow up? And I kept thinking, well, I have to find an answer, and it has to be this definitive answer. And instead, I had that winding path.
Yeah.
Right. And so I've collected all these different experiences and all these different tools along the way. And now I finally come to see that as a strength, that I can, that I have a breadth that I can draw from.
Yeah.
In addition to depth in certain areas.
So that's sort of like health for me, health hats. I know a little bit about a lot and not a lot about much.
And
but I think it's, I resonate with that because I work with a lot of specialists. It's just amazing that how challenging it is for them to talk to each other or understand each other. Yeah. And so I think having the spice of generalists is really important.
Yeah, it's kind of we're the connectors.
Right.
I often serve as an interpreter. You know, I can sit in a meeting and hear people talking, and I think, ah, you're trying to say this and you're trying to say that, and it's missing. You're missing each other in some way.
Yeah.
Right. And so you see that throughout organizations and teams.
Right.
And so being able to listen very deeply and again, kind of mirror back, convey back things that maybe people already know but haven't been willing to see, or they just haven't quite heard between the lines when they're talking with each other. So I do think that, and maybe that even goes back to some of the international work, right? There's an intercultural interplay there.
Yes.
When people don't understand each other's languages, or maybe they're saying the same thing, or have the same human desires and instincts, but they're, you know, kind of hidden in their own ways of talking about the world.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's something that I find very interesting.
I'm thinking about this, the impact, the the micro and the macro. And if I, when I think about the impact that I have had in my work, often I can see that I worked with one person who had an aha.
Right.
And that was a person of influence. And so, although the impact was for one, for me, they're a person who is really touches a lot.
Yes.
And so then I feel like, okay, well, he or she is going to carry that.
I've had that same reflection recently because I did. I was so drawn to macro level work. Mm-hmm. You know, originally I studied speech pathology, which was a very, you know, interpersonal practice. Mm-hmm. And then I was drawn to the macro level work. And now I kind of feel in some ways I've come full circle to that exact same realization that you can impact one person and you what they go on to do with their lives. Right. And just maybe there's a seed in there that you planted.
Yeah, seed. That's
and
a
then
big
it
word.
Grows in some way.
Yeah.
And they're really responsible for a lot of what happens with it. You've planted that seed that has changed something that grows into something much larger.
You may
don't
never
even know.
Right, never know.
Now, a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge when you see your doctor or shaman. Use Abridge when you see your doctor, therapist, or shaman. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations.
There is a proportion of my listeners who are people who have found some equilibrium with some challenges with their health. Mm-hmm. And they have, since they're finding some space, they want to impact for other people who are coming along in a similar journey. What do you think in your experience, do you think might be helpful for those people who are young in their advocacy? What lessons have you learned that may be helpful?
Mm. Well, the first thing that comes to mind was my own struggle finding some sense of equilibrium because I went through a full professional burnout moment in my career. I'm someone who needs the balance and the time to reset. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm out and hanging out at a party, well, I'm going to need some downtime the next day. Mm-hmm. I can't be on all the time. I don't know that you would call me an introvert, but maybe an introverted extrovert, right? Yeah. I need that balance. And so, and also raising kids teaches many of us this, that we sort of reach a point at which we just don't have anything more to give unless we're filling up our own cups. So, you know, the putting on your own mask before assisting others is very real, and we can't just as advocates or as parents or caregivers, we can't just give everything that we have to someone else. We must fill our own cup and put our own mask on first. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lesson I wish people could learn without having to do it the hard way.
Yes.
And I find for myself, we're in a society that wants to do more, more, more all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes for my clients, I can help them recognize that they're trying to give more than they have and that you lose your effectiveness when you don't find some balance and take care of yourself and kind of counter that. There will always be more to do in this society.
I know that in the various teams that I've led as a leader in quality management, the people that I hired and worked with were very go.
Yeah.
And I'm go. Mm-hmm. But it was nice when I got to the point of maturity of realizing that our expectations were way more than everybody else's. Mm. And so we could afford to back off a little and take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. That was an important moment. Mm-hmm. That so I think what you're saying about self-care, that you can do it slower. Right. You can afford to rest.
Right.
I mean, you have to rest.
Right. And sometimes we don't fully embrace that until there is some sort of a health crisis that forces us
to slow
down and take care of ourselves.
Right.
You know, I have a friend who dealt with cancer at quite a young age, and she's been reflecting on how it's just forced her to slow way down, you know, and take a breath. And she's someone who kept really busy. And so, you know, that lesson seems to be there for a lot of people. If you don't do it on your own, someday you're forced to slow it.
So another thing that I've experienced in advocacy is when I first started blogging, I used to talk about the magic levers of best health. And looking for those small things that have a big impact. And we've talked about one, which is the individual. What are other, so taking care of yourself, supporting the individual, what are other big impact?
So then my mind goes to the societal structures that reinforce. So we talked about, like, we overemphasize the individual in our society and believe that if we just pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, we could all be successful. We look at all the ways in which individual choice is an individual responsibility. When in working with organizations, I see all the places where the structure of the organization makes it easier for some and harder for others, right? Or who are the voices that you're hearing and who are the voices that you're not hearing? The questions you ask, who's at the table, who's in the room, the structure of how the conversation happens, right? We know that some of us are more dominant in group conversations than others. And so I try to work a lot in my facilitation work, in my strategic planning support for organizations to examine the ways in which the structures might be illuminating some voices over others, and then actively look for ways to bring forward that marginalized voice or perspective.
Or just a different.
Just a different. That's right. It's okay to disagree. We don't all have to nod our heads and agree and help. But I know you've done this work throughout your career of helping leaders of organizations be open and feel comfortable with the vulnerability of being criticized. That their ideas could be criticized in a constructive way by folks who are seeing the impact, and that they might say, that's right, you have a great, you know, point, let's make a change. So supporting leaders who have impact within their organizations, right, of hundreds or thousands of people whose lives might change or voices might be heard, depending on how comfortable that leader is in their own skin and being able to hear the sort of radical candor of their constituencies. So yeah, I think that's where you get into the macro opportunity.
We homeschooled together for, I don't even know how many years.
For me, it was two.
How do you think that homeschooling impacted your view about the larger world or social justice or advocacy or the work you're doing now? How do you think?
I guess the main thing I think about is that it allowed us to think more creatively, right? So we had schoolwork that was mandated by the local school system, or maybe it's the state. They had workbooks we had to work through and so on, and tests, standardized tests that we needed to come in and take. But we, by and large, my recollection is that we did those in the first couple hours of the morning. And so we were able to get through the stuff that maybe in a classroom, it's going to take all day to get all the students to move through. And so then after that, we could build things. We could essentially test out, right? We had a concept and we could test and have proof of concept right there, whether it was kind of building something with our hands in cardboard boxes, or traveling. My mom took me to Mexico for 4 to 6 weeks when I was homeschooled. So I had that direct exposure to all these different cultures and languages. And so we just had the time and space for the type of learning that now we've realized is really impactful for students, right? It's not just doing the homework or the worksheets or the rote memorization. It's being able to connect disparate ideas or being able to create something, being able to try and fail at something, right? You hear that a lot now, people realizing if we want to be innovative, students need to be able to fail. But there's so much focus on grades and achievement and what do I need to do to get the A to get to the next thing that we're really not saying, what do I need to do to learn or to become a better learner, mm-hmm. right? Learning to ask questions, the questions mm-hmm. that matter. And mm-hmm. so I think homeschooling just created the time and the space. And because there were a few students, right, and we all mm-hmm. could interact with each other, mm-hmm. then in a kind of close-knit, deep way, mm-hmm. then we had the opportunity to think about things differently, ask different questions, try different things mm-hmm. that sometimes just get squeezed out of an academic day, especially now that we want more and more students in a classroom with one teacher mm-hmm. and students come with all these outside challenges, and it's just a lot to expect. Yeah.
Anika, anything you want to ask me?
Oh, my. What did you learn from bringing up this small herd of kids? We all ran as a tribe, you know. Every yeah. day you could look outside and find kids from multiple families.
Right.
Whether we were riding our big wheels down yeah. the road mm-hmm. or sledding through yeah. the trees. And now I'm raising my kids, you know. So looking back on your time as a
yeah.
parent,
yeah.
What did that teach you?
I think it really taught me about, first, how many different ways there are to learn. Mm. To try to sense what interests you, mm-hmm. what interests Simon, what interested Reuben. Mm-hmm. And like, did it interest me too? Because mm-hmm. basically I'm a selfish person. and so if it interested me as well, yeah. well, let's explore it.
Yeah.
If not, who?
Yeah.
And making the connection and connecting to an expert.
Yeah.
We put our careers on hold mm-hmm. to do homeschooling. Mm-hmm. And that was a total blessing mm-hmm. that I feel like it just informed and enriched my nursing, mm-hmm. my advocacy now, that I spent that time with you guys. And that was the right value,
mm-hmm.
you know, to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, so many lessons go back to how we raise our children, how we parent.
Totally.
Often in professional settings, I find myself going back to, well, it depends on what kind of parent you are, right?
Right, right.
And it could be a parent, you know, literally a parent to your own children, or it could be, you know, how do you care for others who are in your care?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the ahas that I had just hanging out one day and when you all were older, and you know, I thought that in homeschooling, my wife took much more lead mm-hmm. and much more direction in what we were doing. And I was more, okay, well, we're living in West Virginia. There's a lot about the Civil War. Let's study the Civil War. Or it's a homeschooling law that we wanted to get passed. Let's go to Charleston and advocate. So I was more of the
opportunistic.
Yes, and, right. Go. Okay, yeah. Like... yeah. I have to say that one of the proudest things I have is you saying that Ann and I are an example.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
You know, I'm so proud of it.
And it's, you know, kind of rare, because staying married for all these years
yeah.
and staying in love is, mm-hmm. it's the work of human connections and human relationships.
Yeah.
And those are hard.
They are hard.
And, you know,
right.
so you should be proud
yeah.
of
yeah.
that. And you're reaping the benefits of it, as you know.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I love the expanded notion of family. Anika is part of our family. We are a part of hers. We are her extra parents. She's our extra daughter. She has brothers from another mother. I had extra parents too. We are fortunate and privileged. We feel safe opening our hearts while parenting, advocating, teaching, and learning. We can pay it forward. She's paying it forward. Powerful stuff, spiritual strength. Happy 33rd birthday, Opa. See the show notes. previous podcasts and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.